From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, the 25th of September, 2019, and I am happy to tell you that I am at Norwich University in Northfield, Vermont this morning for the Norwich University Military Writers Symposium. It's a two-day event here on the Northfield campus where they bring in nationally known writers who are expert in military tactics and strategy and policy, and deliver a whole bunch of classroom talks and other events. Among the features are a public event this afternoon at the Plumlee Armory on campus, where there's going to be a panel discussion about the future of warfare, featuring some of the scholars who are visiting the campus this week. And here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, we're glad to say that we have some of the scholars who are visiting the campus with us this morning, and as well as Norwich President Richard Schneider. President Schneider is going to be talking to us about the Military Writers Symposium, which there have been a couple of changes in it, including in the name is changed from the Colby Military Writers Symposium, as it was last held a year ago this past spring, and it's now the Norwich University Military Writers Symposium. We may talk to President Schneider a little bit about that, as well as the school's bicentennial. It was founded in 1819, so it is 200 years old this year. There have been a whole host of events celebrating that milestone, and other news from here, a very successful fundraising drive we'll get into with President Schneider. Later on, back to a couple of the additional speakers and scholars who are joining the campus this week to talk to the future military leaders who are studying here at the nation's oldest military college. I want to bring in my first guest. Peter Warren Singer is a writer on military policy. He has a book out called Like War. He has really been focusing recently on the various strategies related to the fact that war is becoming, and we'll talk about this a little bit, I think, somewhat easier to wage. You can get small, very deadly weapons, as were used in the attack on the Saudi oil facility just a couple of weeks ago, and we're going to talk some about that and what it means for the future of military strategy and what the United States might be thinking about in terms of its own defenses and so on. So, Peter Warren Singer, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And so tell us a little bit about you. You had actually a column in the New York Times on September the 18th, The Future of War is Already Here, and a very interesting piece. I was just reading it before we came on the air this morning, and you're saying that these new tactics are changing the calculus of military intervention and the whole approach to warfare, really. Tell us, give us a recap for any of our listeners who didn't catch the column in the Times.
Sure. So my work has been on how we've seen changes in warfare, particularly driven by new groups and new technologies. So past books looking at everything from cybersecurity to the growing use of robotics, drones, to a look at future warfare, and particularly what might battles between states like Russia, China, the United States might look like. And this piece was looking at is basically a reaction to what played out in Saudi Arabia, where you had an attack on two oil facilities that wasn't one that the Saudis had planned for. They'd been planning for sort of, you know, large-scale long-range missiles, and instead it was a swarm of small drones and low-flying cruise missiles that came in. And there are a lot of different lessons to take away from it, but one of them was not just this notion of, you know, as the title put it, the future of war is here, the idea of a swarm of robotic planes coming in and taking out a target. It's, you know, actually the opening of the Gerard Butler movie out right now. But it's also something that has to change the calculus of intervention when you get into wars, because now not just major states, but small, medium states, even non-state actors, have the ability to hit back in a way that they didn't before. So, for example, the Saudis intervened into the Yemeni civil war a couple years back. They thought it would be an easy win for them, and instead the rebels there have been hitting back with missiles, with drone attacks, and it shows how, you know, in a certain way of thinking about it, the barriers to these technologies, the barriers to entry are lowering for the rebels. That also means in turn we need to raise the barriers to entry for what wars we think we're going to intervene in, because the costs of them are not going to be so easy as people often push.
Yeah, and the cost of this kind of attack that occurred in Saudi Arabia seems to be going down in terms of certainly human lives. I mean, it used to be in the prior decades of warfare, you talk about missiles. I mean, back in the day, people were flying planes with human beings piloting them, and if you wanted to launch such an attack, you ran a risk of losing some planes and losing some highly trained flyers, and big risks there. Operating perhaps, most likely I would think, as a brake on a decision to launch this kind of raid. Now with drones able to do this, and cheap drones, it's much lower risk and much lower cost for an actor that may want to launch a raid or an attack as the one in Saudi Arabia occurred.
Well, it's interesting. You and I are sitting right now in the museum at Norwich, and it's filled with all these great artifacts from the different wars that our nation has fought in, and the role that Norwich alums played in it. And just over your shoulder is a display on the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. And it's a reminder to me, linking to what you said, that there's always been the false promise made of easy, costless wars. And I say false promise because they, of course, never turn out that way, even if you have the most advanced technology. What we're seeing now is that these new technologies make that even more of a false promise, whether it is a war with Iran, or if you look at the example of the Saudis, when they entered into the civil war in Yemen 4 years back, they thought it would be easy, costless, mostly an airstrike campaign. The other side couldn't hit back at them. And here we are 4.5 years later, over 70,000 killed, but also the adversary maybe not using jet fighters to hit back, but using small drones, missiles, is hit back at everything from airports to, for a period of time, it took half of Saudi oil production offline. And so it's something to think about as we go through our own debates about conflicts to enter into. You have to go into them with a clear eyes as to both the benefits and the costs, and be wary of those people that are selling you a false promise that somehow this is going to be easy, cheap, costless.
And so, I mean, it seems to raise the specter, what you're saying, that if the United States did decide to go into a war somewhere, say even in the Middle East, it wouldn't be that hard for an enemy actor to just essentially pull up some kind of a submarine or other craft off the coast of the United States and send us.
It may not necessarily be a submarine or a drone. It may be one of the other things that's opened up is an entire new domain of warfare, which is cyber, and we've seen examples of that in terms of both what you might view as offensive kinetic action. A way of thinking about this is it's using cyber, so using digital means, not merely to steal information, but to cause a physical change in the target. So the United States actually pioneered this targeting Iran several years back. We had a digital weapon called Stuxnet, and it didn't steal Iranian nuclear research. We know how to build an atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. Instead, it caused the machinery that they were using to essentially break itself. It spun too fast. The pressure settings were changed. And so that opened up an entire new realm of warfare. So, for example, we have later seen the Russians engage in attacks that for a period of time took Ukrainian power grids offline. About 200,000 people lost power in the middle of winter. So it might be that kind of direct kinetic attack, or it might be something that we wrestled with in the Like War project. Like was a book that I did recently that looked at how you might not just have cyber attacks that are about hacking a network, but they're about hacking the people on the network by driving ideas viral. And so you think about these influence operations that have targeted, you know, for example, what played out targeting the 2016 U.S. election, where you have a foreign actor reaching into your body politic and essentially attacking it through digital means. So what we're getting at here is in a global world where we're all networked, you need to understand these connection points, how it opens up new opportunities, yes, but it also opens up new vulnerabilities.
Yeah, that is for sure. The new vulnerabilities I'm thinking are things that people have not thought about, or at least have been sort of behind the curve on thinking about. In the 25 or 30 years we've really developed, the internet as a major force in the world these days. I mean, everybody's all excited about the technology there all through the 80s and 90s and aughts, people getting used to using email and all the other, and now Twitter and Facebook and so on. It all seems like a wonderful new world, except when you start to think about the sort of vulnerabilities that it creates. And that is a real issue. I think one of the biggest issues faced by not just the United States, but every country in the world. Right.
Absolutely.
Now,
we've seen over 30 other democracies targeted by these kind of influence operations, their elections, since the U.S. 2016 election. So it's hitting not just us, it's hitting pretty much every other democracy out there. Now, let's be clear here. You know, no one's saying stop using the internet, stop using, you know, Facebook or email. No, I mean, it's changed our world. It's changed our social lives, business, and created all sorts of, you know, great things. But it also comes with new challenges. And one of the particular challenges is the way that it has allowed some of the most kind of toxic forces online, be it hate, extremism, be it conspiracy theory. If you think about some of the crazy, you know, whether it's Pizzagate or anti-vaxxer conspiracy theory that's brought back so many childhood diseases, to foreign disinformation campaigns that are trying to warp politics. You know, it's helped these toxic sides go viral. And so one of the things that we need to do as a nation is go after this in the same way we would think about, you know, public health or cybersecurity. There's a role for everyone. There's a role for government. There's a role for business. There's a role for you and I. No one would say in public health, the government created the Center for Diseases Control. I guess that means I don't need to wash my hands. Or, you know, no one would say, I use two-factor on my Gmail. So I guess that means the U.S. military doesn't need a cyber command. No, you need these layers of it. And we particularly need it to combat these kind of disinformation threats that are going after our democracy. There's a really fascinating comparison. You know, we're up here right near the Canadian border, and there's just a fascinating comparison between how Canada and the United States are handling this. Canada has an upcoming election. They have a national strategy to protect their election that's bringing together everything from government to media. By contrast, in the U.S., I mean, we're, you know, not just leaving ourselves open to this. You've got people in our body politic who are the translation term for it is fellow traveler and useful idiot. It's people who aren't directly working for, but amplify the foreign government disinformation campaign. And until we get a handle on that, we're going to continue to see this kind of poison pushed into our body politic.
And we only have a few minutes left to go, unfortunately, but I did want to touch on a little bit more on this issue of actually using social media. You talk about your book, Like War, talks about the use of social media basically in promulgating attacks on another country. By the way, social media, Like War, your book about this, comes out next week in paperback, I believe. Is that right?
Yes.
Real problem, it seems to be, that the United States, unlike it sounds like in Canada, is leaving itself pretty wide open to, and it's the laissez-faire thing, I think, where people don't want a lot of government regulation here, so we leave ourselves vulnerable sometimes. And during the break, we were talking about the 2016 election. You're of the view that that the president should be impeached and perhaps should have been impeached earlier.
Sure. So that doesn't, that I should be clear, that's different than if you're talking about the election itself. So if you're talking about impeachment is not a conviction, it's a trial. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear that there is enough to put the president on trial. Indeed, there was enough coming out of the Mueller report, not just the activity itself, but the very clear obstruction of justice. Indeed, before that, you also have the fact that the president was named as essentially a co-conspirator in a federal court case. It was individual one, in which the other party to it pled guilty. So you have all that, and then you have the more recent Ukraine episode that involves both. Appears to be a quid pro quo misuse to go after a political rival, but you also again have an obstruction case. So you have all that going on, and then you also have the fascinating issue in terms of not just the law but conduct in office. Both Andrew Johnson's impeachment back in the day to there's a great quote from actually Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. Quote, a president doesn't even have to be convicted of a crime to be impeached. Impeachment is about restoring honor and integrity to the office, end quote. It's going to be really interesting to see how Lindsey Graham, who said that in 99, squares that up today. Yeah. When we talk about, I live in Virginia, and actually have ties to the Charlottesville area, and it was horrific to have a president describing neo-Nazis who had just killed a young woman as, quote, very fine people. That was not honor to the presidency.
A lot there. And, of course, the 1999 comment from Lindsey Graham related to President Bill Clinton, who had some, shall we say, questionable behavior in the Oval Office there.
Absolutely. So if Lindsey wants to be consistent in his beliefs, be consistent.
I'm not sure he does want to be consistent.
we'll find out probably in a little bit.
that sounds like a strong possibility. Of course, Lindsey Graham is one of President Trump's big defenders now, and has been critical of what he considers to be attacks on President Trump. And President Trump does have his defenders. They are folks who have been sticking with him right from the beginning, still do.
Absolutely. And remember he said he could shoot someone. I won't get the quote exactly, but it was roughly, I could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and they'd still vote for me. Yeah. And unfortunately, it feels like that is the case right now, where you literally had first a denial of the action. And then remember when I denied it? And well, actually, I did it, and it's okay. And that's a really odd pattern, but I think it links back to that what he said might be true, that he could literally openly commit a crime in front of people, and they'd still support him. And that is dangerous to the health of a democracy.
What do you think of the Democrats' role in this, in terms of their earlier shyness around, last spring when the Mueller report was coming out, and then Robert Mueller testifying over the summer, Nancy Pelosi reluctant to begin formal impeachment proceedings, and then, of course, just yesterday she came out and said, following this latest scandal involving President Trump's interactions with Ukraine, she said, yes, it's time to start an impeachment inquiry.
Yeah, it's interesting because, again, it's an inquiry. It's not a conviction. It's mm-hmm. Let's bring out the evidence. And I think you could reasonably accuse some of the Dems of weirdly playing politics, because earlier they were at least some of them were, sort of licking their finger and putting it into the wind to see which way the winds were blowing. And maybe, just maybe, the polls aren't showing it, or maybe just maybe it might not work out in the Senate. And it's fascinating if you go back and look at, for instance, Nixon at the start of the Watergate hearings had pretty decent polls. polling, but once the evidence was put out there, then the public attitude changed. And that's the same thing, you know, let the evidence go out there and see it rather than decide things by the polls. Similarly, if you're going to say, well, we shouldn't do anything because of what the Senate may or may not do, then you're deferring, again, what is a airing of evidence to politics. So I think it's, you know, essentially in a weird way, Trump forced their hand by being so overt about this. And I don't think uncoincidentally the actions that he took were literally the days after the Mueller report.
Yeah, that's just amazing. And it strikes me as really, I don't know, I'm not an expert on psychology, but it almost seems like there's some strange psychology playing out here. When the Mueller report comes out, it doesn't really seem to land very heavily. And he says, okay, well,
Saying if someone just got away with it, that they might have thought, hold it, I could get away with it again. Yeah. That's pretty straightforward psychology.
I seem to have shaken the cops. Let me rob this other bank over here. Well, Peter Warren Miller, Peter Warren Singer, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. Fascinating conversation. Your book is live.
Like War.
Like War, there it is. And it is out in paperback next week. I'm sure it's well worth a read, all about social media as a tool of international interference, basically. Back in a few minutes on the Dave Graham Show.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toton Code, Fashion Forward, Tonya DeBellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Continuing our presentation this morning from Norwich University's, and we are very happy to be here for the Norwich University Military Writers Symposium. Lots going on at Norwich at the Northfield campus these days. They've got a little bit of a bicentennial happening this year. It's the 200th anniversary of this esteemed military college here. The oldest private military college in the country, from what I understand. And my next guest is the president of Norwich University. He has been for 28 years, which is an amazing tenure in academia as the head of any kind of a college or university. Richard Snyder has been at the helm of Norwich University that entire time, and he's kind enough to join me this morning. Good morning, President Snyder.
Good morning, Dave. Hi to all your listeners.
And I just wanted to broaden the scope here a little bit. We talked to Peter Warren Singer, one of the presenters at the Military Writers Symposium, about his view that the technology and strategy of, and the thinking about whether to go to war, all changing in big ways out there, as evidenced by the recent raid on Saudi Arabia's premier oil facilities. But I wanted to broaden the scope beyond the military strategy that is really the focus of this symposium, and ask you more broadly about Norwich University, because the place is booming. So many colleges in Vermont are hurting, and I come down here and it seems like most of the buildings are either new or just renovated, or what the heck's going on?
Well, we're certainly experiencing some wonderful revivals, I guess, here at Norwich. We are full, David, as you said. In fact, I can't take one more kid. I mean, I'm making next year's freshman class because we're going to have a bunch of people graduate for seniors. But we are absolutely full. In fact, all the lounges are taken as now reconverted into dorm space. All the quads are filled. All the triples are filled. So the school is at 2,400 undergraduate population, and the graduate school is probably about 2,000. So graduate students are online, so they're working adults and working and having families and still getting their academics done. But the undergraduates, the 2,400, we build Norwich just like the Department of Defense, two in uniform for every one civilian. You can't go to war without your contractor anymore, and we're talking about the war of the future. And civilian people think somewhat differently than military people. I'm sure you're shocked at that, but that's just how it is. And listen, guys, it's one team, one fight.
Yep.
And I got to tell you, when I was commissioned an ensign in the United States Coast Guard in 1968, we had one enemy, the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And all my classmates looked the same, talked the same, prayed the same, ate the same, thought the same. Leadership was much easier. And, of course, we had no social media either, taking pictures of everything we were doing. Today, any second lieutenant or ensign in any one of our services can get the country in big trouble. And leadership is much more complicated today. And that's one of the things we're doing here. And I think why we're full, David, is that we are a leadership laboratory. We are getting our hands done at this. And we create teams of learners, and they're all different. And you need to lead different kinds of people in your teams now. And in any life of any second lieutenant or ensign, you will be having civilians embedded with you. Perhaps they're journalists. Maybe they're NGOs. Maybe they're three-letter agency people. I mean, we go to war now as we need all the elements of government to help us. So you'll have justice, and you'll have energy, and you'll have firearms and tobacco. I mean, all those guys go together, and we sometimes think differently. So it's much more difficult now than it was in the 60s and the 70s, even the 80s. This war of the future, everybody's got to pay a lot more attention here. We need an educated citizenry, which is exactly why we've been doing Colby for 25 years. And I hope some of your listeners will come this afternoon for the open session or the Todd Lecture Series tonight, which is open to the public, to get educated about this, because every citizen has a stake in it.
Yeah, and the stakes really are changing and making it much more so. I mean, we saw asymmetrical warfare in a big way on 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I think people came to understand if commercial jetliners can be used as basically weapons of mass destruction, really, mm-hmm. then you are in a different world from what you used to be when you were sending bombers into other countries to...
Well, absolutely right. And it's even gotten more complicated now if you layer over artificial intelligence over that. And we have non-manned vehicles, ships and planes and drones and things like that. So there's a lot of ethical questions. There's a lot of policy issues. And, of course, a lot of our enemies don't really care about policy and ethics and morality. So it's gotten much more complicated for our students. Now, that's one reason why I think we are investing in school. Our alumni, we just completed a campaign here, the Bicentennial Campaign, in honor of our 200th birthday, and it was wonderful. It was this weekend. We had probably 6,000 people here for the last 4 days, and we're still kind of all like just trying to grab our breath right now. I mean, we doubled the size of Northfield in one afternoon, and it was fabulous, though. But this gang, for the last 5 years, has been helping me raise the money for what we needed to invest in school, and thankfully, we raised well over our goal. The goal was $100 million. Mm-hmm. We actually raised that a year early, so the trustees raised my goal to $110 million and gave me a year to get the other 10 in, and we just finished booking the campaign at $118
million. Wow, congratulations.
And thanks. Yeah. And it's only because we have friends and alums that believe in our mission of creating the next generation of leaders.
Now that money, you've done a bunch of a new $24 million academic building.
Yes, that's Mack Hall, and it's an all cyber building. So what we had to do is recreate our academic space, because first off, the students today learn differently than you and I did when we were kids. I mean, we had classrooms here with rows in classrooms that look like a platoon. I mean, there were five across and 12 deep. And mm-hmm. that's not how kids learn today. They move stuff around, and the furniture we had wasn't movable. And then we didn't have any really like big flat screens or where you could do multimedia stuff or pull in a clip from a video or an audio from your show and talk about that, you know, with the students. So the Mack Hall is a $25 million building, $5 million of which is technology, and we now do cyber offense and defense in that building. We also, through a contract with our state, our faculty members and our students actually monitor and protect all the state's networks because our state's being attacked. I mean, Norwich is being attacked. I suspect WDEV is being attacked. And so how do you know when you're attacked, and then how do you restore after you're attacked, and how do you know what they took when they came in and took all your Social Security numbers, David, from your paychecks? And this is like, oh, my goodness, this is really tricky. So we're producing. We had to create and invest to create the spaces in which our faculty could teach the new warfare of the future. And so we've done that, and we are in a great position right now to start our third century of service to our students and our country.
You know, and I got to say, especially in contrast to the struggles that I hear about, I've had many interviews on my show in just recent months. I guess three Vermont colleges have
heartbreaking
closed this year, and Norwich has found, it seems, the formula, or at least a formula.
Well, our business model has been since 1819. And by the way, we've been bankrupt twice, and we had a huge fire and went almost out of existence. So, listen, running a school is not easy, and the demographics are against us in New England. That we're not producing enough 18-year-olds in New England. And when I arrived in 92, this was primarily a New England school.
Yeah.
All right, so all you got to do is look at the census data. This isn't brain surgery, guys. This is look where the babies are being born. Mm-hmm. And the jobs were moving south and southwest. So I started sending admissions counselors to California, Texas, and Florida. I picked those three states because there were tons of kids there. But more importantly, that's where we've located the United States military.
Yeah.
And our brand is very well established there. So now California, Texas, and Florida are in the top 10 states sending us students here. Hmm. We have to go where the students are and attract them to this beautiful heaven here in Vermont. So that's one thing that's helped. And we started that about 21, 22 years ago. The other benefit of being a long-seated president is you got enough time to write the plan and then execute the plan, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the average tenure, unfortunately, of a college president today is about 4.7 years, and
wow,
you don't have enough time to see things through.
So you got about seven times the average.
Yes. bigger isn't better.
Yeah.
I mean, about year 8 or 9, the headhunters start calling if you've had a successful first presidency at a small school, and a lot of our schools in Vermont are small. So these are starter schools, and I said, don't call me, guys. I'm not going anywhere, as long as they want to keep me. I mean, I would go and look for a job if the trustees said, hey, Richard, your time is up. But they never said that. And I where else can I go and lead a corps of cadets like this or have a mission like this? So our business model is very simple since 1819. If we educate American students for the risks to this republic, the republic will always send us their best kids. And that's, David, that's exactly what has happened. So in 1819, what was the risk to us? The risk was the damn redcoats coming over the Green Mountains of Vermont again through Canada.
Yep.
And so we were an infantry school. Well, what's the risk today? It's cyber and AI. That's why I'm teaching what we're doing. So the three pillars of our long-range plan that takes us to 2035 that we've just finished writing for our new president, by the way, is that it has to be relevant. The stuff that you're teaching, the students need to want.
Yeah.
Because if you offer something and no one buys it, you're out of business, right? So relevance, flexible. These students want to be flexible. They want a semester abroad. So we're pushing. We had 95 students out right today. David, while you and I are talking in this beautiful museum, 95 students, Norwich students, are all over the world studying. And I would love to get more and more out of them. It's expensive, but we're pushing them out. And the last piece is affordable. We've been really banking in the endowment so that we can produce wonderful scholarships for smart kids to come here. So if you are relevant, if you are flexible, and you are affordable, students will come.
Some folks see, you talk about what are the threats to the republic. Some people see threats to the republic from our internal politics right now. Do you share that view? And what do you do about restoring, I don't know, ethics?
Civility? How about that? Let's try right there.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, our governor was on campus on Friday. He spoke at the gala, the bicentennial gala.
Yep.
And talk about a guy that's dignified with grace but can work across the aisle.
And very worried about civility.
Exactly. And he's a leader, and that's what we need. I told him he could have been a Norwich kid. He should have been a Norwich kid, but he was a UVM kid, so that's okay.
Oh, well.
But, I'm very worried about that. But listen, the Republic has been through some very rough times before, and we have survived. This experiment that we are conducting here as a republic is very resilient. But I will tell you that I am worried about it. I am worried about the threats to America, both domestic and external. And I took an oath as a commissioned officer for 30 years as a Coast Guard officer to protect this Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That's the oath that we take as commissioned officers. We do not have allegiance to a person. We have an allegiance to an office and an idea, and we only follow legal orders.
Mm-hmm.
That's why these kids have to be so smart, too. What's the legal order and what isn't? And we spend a lot of time. So the humanities and ethics and morality have a large component in our curriculum, even if you're an engineer. a third of the engineering curriculum is the socio-humanistic electives. And we argue and talk about those kind of things because you have to be a well-rounded citizen. And by the way, our English majors have two lab sciences because you have to know a lot of science to be a citizen today.
That is for sure. Social media, media literacy and that sort of thing, are those becoming more important subjects in a university setting? Should that be taught earlier in school?
It definitely needs to be taught earlier. It needs to be taught almost immediately. And these kids are just wired to their machines, I got to tell you. But do they know, can they discern, reading this piece, let's say on a blog or something, is it true or not?
Yeah.
They need to know how to research that and figure that out. In our mission statement, we talk about being able to, Thomas Jefferson's words, to hold many ideas in your brain at one time, but then try to figure out what's right.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true today. They're also greatly at risk. I mean, they're divulging stuff in social media that they should never tell anyone. And they just don't know any better because they just think their friends are reading it. The fact of the matter is, everyone's reading it.
Yeah.
And there are no secrets on the Internet.
Or everyone can read it, for sure.
Yes.
At maybe the most inopportune times, late 20 years
later. Well, listen, if you want to get a job, don't you think your employer at WDEV is checking what your blog looks like?
Is this
a person we want to hire to represent our company?
That's very likely, yeah. And let's talk a little bit about the symposium, President Schneider.
Sure.
It is something that Norwich has done for how long?
25 years. It's one of the most exhilarating academic and military events we have on campus, and I think Captain Partridge, our founder, would be very proud of us and cheering us on from the sideline. This was actually an idea from General W. Russell Todd, my predecessor, mm-hmm. wanting to bring military authors to campus. He was never able to pull it off, I think, financially and a few other things, and when I got here, we got a few things fixed and worked on the budget and what have you, but I love the idea, and so Ed Tracy, who was an employee at the time, I asked Ed to lead this, and he was the founding executive director. Since then, we brought over 100 authors to campus, and you started to interview some of them. By the way, I want to thank WDEV for covering this, and this is what Partridge would have wanted to have happen at his university, the best of both military thinking and academic thinking all pushed together in one event. And how do we make citizens of the future and have them great military leaders also? So the speakers that we have are spectacular. I mean, we have brought the best speakers in this topic to this little state in Vermont for the last 25 years. And we've had plenty of the public sit in on these public opportunities and then listen to your show as well and listen to speakers like Singer. And so the Corps mustered at 5:30 this morning and marched down to the gym to hear from our Medal of Honor recipient, who's here, David Bellavieva, who is the only living, I think, Medal of Honor recipient from the War on Terror. He was, oh my God, did he knock it out of the ballpark. But talking about leadership and why senior NCOs and young officers have a special sacred bond and how they help young officers develop into unbelievably great senior officers. All the kind of things that our young students needed to hear because that's what they want to be. And he's a living example of the best of America.
That is that's a tremendous tribute. He's going to be on the program a little bit later this morning. The and one of the speakers, I believe, in some of the events here on campus mm-hmm. in the next day. And actually, it's a two-day event starting today, correct?
Yes. Well, actually, we were hard at it yesterday.
Oh, okay. So
and tonight we have the Todd Lecture Series. Now, that's another interesting thing, David, that actually is named for my predecessor and his wonderful wife. Unfortunately, late wife, Carol Todd,
mm-hmm.
They were such a landmark here in central Vermont that a foundation actually gifted us a wonderful gift that we can have these public lectures. And so there will be a Todd Lecture Series tonight, and Dr. Singer is actually the one that's going to be giving forth this evening. And that's open to the public. It's free.
Yeah, Dr. Singer, P.W. Singer, or Peter Warren Singer, was the first guest on the program this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, what an impressive man he is. I mean, he just has a lot of knowledge and information about the changing style of technology and then the ethics and all the other policy issues that are raised by changes in technology in warfare currently. Fascinating conversation. I'm sure the talk tonight will be well worth it.
Absolutely. And the panel today at 2, these four authors are of the same quality as Singer. I got to tell you, I think if anyone comes, they're going to have their socks knocked off.
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm quite impressed. I, I, I must say, for the first 23 years of this annual event in Norwich, I was pretty much unaware. And then
we had Tom Clancy here in the beginning. We had W.E.B. Griffin here. How did you miss this?
I don't know. My bad. But I've been here now. This is my second year coming down. It is true, the quality of the folks you're getting here from Harvard and other leading universities and think tanks and military branches, et cetera, truly remarkable to get all these folks gathered at one time in little Northfield.
I love it when they argue.
Uh-huh.
Actually, a panel is kind of boring if they're all kind of agreeing with each other.
Absolutely.
That's not the case here.
Yeah.
And I love it when they get different points of view going, and that's the whole point of college, right, and universities, is to argue about differences of opinion.
Differences of opinion and, the different backgrounds and kind of approaches to the overall strategies and goals of keeping America safe and well protected and so on. I think, obviously, you've got to debate aspects of that.
Absolutely.
Because
right. There's a lot of issues going forward.
No one idea is going to work in all circumstances. That is for sure. I also wondered whether, you think this is something that is going to be a growing thing and a happening thing 50 years from now.
Oh, I think it's going to be even more spectacular here. We have, with the building blocks we put in place and now the facilities and the curriculum in place, I can only see even better days for Norwich ahead in the next 200 years. But I'm confident this topic and this symposium will abide and continue because it's mission critical for us, guys. We need to understand where the world is going. And if you don't do that for your college students, shame on all of us. Because they're the ones, we are leaving them a mess, David. Our generation, yours and mine, I'm looking at you, we're about the same age.
Yep.
We have made a mess out of this right now.
Yeah, I hear that all the time from my kids, that is for
well,
sure.
Well, listen, yeah. The young generation is very upset with us for screwing this up, especially the climate. And pay attention here, all those older people that are listening. They are mad.
Actually, that's a good note to finish on, since this is also kind of climate week. We had started the big world global strike last week. Greta Thunberg's been in the news. What are future military leaders thinking about here? I mean, I hear about the worries, frankly, about the naval base at Norfolk, Virginia, and rising sea levels.
Sinking in the dock. Well, it is a huge problem. I mean, climate change is a national security issue. General Sullivan has been here multiple times, especially as my leader in residence, talking about, listen, there are going to be wars over water, the fact that you don't have it.
Yeah.
And now there'll be other places that are desert now that are going to have too much water. But mass migrations will happen in areas where there's very weak governments, and then all hell breaks loose. And then we go in and try to restore things. So, yes, the climate is a national security issue and therefore critical to Norwich education.
All right. Well, Richard Schneider is the president of Norwich University. Sir, I thank you so much for stopping in this morning and sharing your thoughts. I wish you best of luck as you get ready to retire in May. I'm sure you'll be not completely retired, but pretty busy doing a wide range of stuff. And and congratulate you on this.
Well, thanks. I'm going to miss them and miss you terribly.
Well,
but we'll be listening.
All right.
From Lake Dunmore, which is where we're going.
All right. Well, have a great time down there.
Thanks.
Hey, we're going to take a break for some CBS News at the top of the hour. Words from Talk Media News when we return, and then back to the Norwich Military Writers Symposium. Stay with us.
Ah, sweet September, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back, continuing into the second hour of our special broadcast today. We are at Norwich University in Northfield for the annual Norwich Military Writers Symposium, a a battery of scholars, we might call them, have lined up here at Norwich University, several excellent speakers, and they're going to be, and military people, they're going to be holding a... Okay. Okay. We are back here at Norwich University, and I wanted to continue the discussions here at Norwich. It's the Norwich University Military Writers Symposium, and we have a good lineup of guests continuing into our second hour of the Dave Graham Show here. And we have, I believe we're also going to be talking in the next few minutes with Bob Ney of Talk Media News. We did want to get some discussion on the Dave Graham Show here this morning about the big news out of Washington yesterday. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, announced that she does now want to launch an inquiry into whether the House of Representatives ought to impeach President Donald Trump. This is prompted by the latest iteration of foreign enmeshment in U.S. politics, really. President Trump is alleged to have made a phone call to Ukraine and spoken to the president there about an investigation of Joe Biden, the Democratic candidate for president, of course, former vice president in the Obama administration, and Joe Biden's son, Hunter, who was working in the Ukraine and had been investigated there. The Ukraine, apparently, from what we read in the national press, the New York Times, Washington Post, etc., Ukraine investigated some allegations concerning the younger Biden, determined there wasn't much there, basically dropped the case, and President Trump allegedly called the president of the Ukraine a few days after putting a hold on U.S. military aid to Ukraine and said, we would like you to resume this investigation of both Bidens, of father and son. And this of course, is seen as an effort by the president of the United States to take advantage of his relations with foreign of. Okay, I believe we have Bob Ney actually now on from Talk Media News joining us this morning. And Bob, thank you so much for calling in. Good morning, Bob. Are you with us? I'm not hearing Bob. So let's see. The Speaker of the House yesterday, after extensive meetings with Democratic leadership in the Congress, in the U.S. House of Representatives, held a brief announcement in which she said, yes, we're going to launch an impeachment inquiry. It's going to be six committees in the House involved in investigating various aspects of President Trump's conduct. I'm sure that'll extend not just to this latest issue involving Ukraine, but also the earlier allegations that were dealt with in the Mueller report, which of course came out this past spring after a two-year investigation into allegations that the Russians had interfered in the 2016 election, interference allegedly welcomed by President Trump and his people. And so Robert Mueller testified about his report in late July, and it was just days after that, or maybe just a day, I'm not exactly sure, but very shortly after that, that the president made the phone call to Ukraine and essentially started asking the president of Ukraine to do some interference in the United States 2020 election. 2016, I guess he decided that that one was pretty much settled after the Mueller report came out. Robert Mueller testified about the report, and so let's get our attention turned to 2020, and maybe Ukraine can help. That at least is the allegation that has been leveled in the past week or so by a whistleblower in the government who stepped forward and alerted the intelligence community's inspector general. And let's see if Bob Ney is with us now. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. And you?
I am good.
That's good. So give us your take on what happened yesterday. Of course, I've been talking about sort of filibustering a little bit here about the news out of Washington, the Speaker of the House calling for an impeachment inquiry. This isn't a formal impeachment yet, I guess. How would you describe it?
Well, it's the beginning of the process. You know, I sat through an impeachment myself, which was President Clinton, and people are starting to compare these impeachments. They really are different ball games. The Nixon impeachment was a resignation because he was being threatened with impeachment. The Clinton impeachment was more specific to a specific issue. Did the president commit perjury under oath? A specific issue. This impeachment is an inquiry into a multitude of issues. Now, what sparked the actual, you know, ability of the speaker to come out and say, yes, we're doing an inquiry impeachment, is the fact of the conversation, you know, on the phone by our president and the president of the Ukraine. And so it opens it officially. Right now, there's 203 Democrats that are saying they are supporting an impeachment inquiry. Monday, there was about 160. That's how much has changed.
That is really striking. And, of course, I think two things happened in the last couple of days. Tell me if there are additional factors here. But one was there was an op-ed that was under the joint bylines of several Democratic House members who were in so-called Trump districts or districts where they were considered politically vulnerable because their districts had voted for President Trump, and they perhaps had a thinner than in other places grasp on electoral power, really, in their districts. And so the speaker did not want to put them at risk by having her party be seen as backing impeachment necessarily, until they came out and wrote an op-ed that appeared late Monday in the Washington Post, and the op-ed basically said, no, we are ready to move ahead, damn the torpedoes kind of thing. And then the speaker coming out herself and saying, okay, let's do this then. Those are the big factors, right?
Oh, yes. I think you're 100% right, Dave. Those are the factors, because up to this point in time, the speaker has evaded, you know, the impeachment process for specific reasons, even though we all hear we don't now anymore, but we heard about AOC and all the progressives. The truth is, too, there are 45 Democratic seats that were won by moderate Democrats who really were very, very cautious about the entire impeachment issue. I think with some of them coming out gave Speaker Pelosi probably the ability to say we're going to go ahead and go forward with it. Frankly, I think that the speaker should have waited a day. Well, I think they all should have waited a day, because the president's going to come out with the transcript today, and then we'll see, is it as bad as they say, or is it not as bad as they say? And if it's not, of course, the president's going to say, you're impeaching me, trying to impeach me over nothing. Now, if it's as bad as they say, then you're going to see Republicans start to react.
You know, I almost wondered whether I kind of agree with you. I was wondering whether it would have been better strategy to wait a day or even two to have a couple of the other shoes drop, because this could end up effectively. I mean, I don't expect it would be intentional, but it could effectively end up being a trap for the Democrats and frankly, an awful lot of the national media, who have been all over cable news in the past 48 hours or so, talking about this stuff as if the president, essentially painting it in the worst light, and therefore the president needs to be impeached, et cetera. Boy, if it comes out that the transcript shows it to be a dud, and or the inspector general's report comes out by the end of the week, let's say, and indicates that there's not as much there as people have been saying, that'll look really bad, won't it?
Will be cry wolf. I mean, if that is the case, really they're going to be in trouble over how to backtrack off.
Yep.
And if they proceed on impeachment, you know, based on something that's not the case, they're really going to have trouble. I still think in the end, too, either way, I think this really is going to affect also Joe Biden. I really just think it's going to affect him in a not so good a way. With the Democrats.
Yeah, I suspect you may be right, but I'm not sure that in the minds of a lot of Democrats, frankly, I think they were ready to move on, even if the polls don't quite show that yet. Certainly, a lot of the party activists and leaders are ready to try a different flavor, if you know what I mean. That's just my sense of it, and you're starting to see this in the polls, where Elizabeth Warren now holds a narrow lead over Joe Biden in the latest polling. And I think that I don't know that it is as simple as just a Trump Biden thing here at this point in terms of the 2020 campaign, but I think what you're going to end up with is some real, if in fact this plays out in the way I just described, where it turns out to be kind of a dud, you are going to be it's really going to give a lot of ammunition for President Trump and his supporters to wag their fingers at the Democrats and at the national media as being just, you know, out to get the president, all the things he's been saying, essentially, because now whether the Democrats could turn around and kind of resurrect a lot of what the allegations were in the Mueller report. I mean, there was a lot there. And then there's other stuff about, you know, the Michael Cohen matter with, you know, Stormy Daniels et al. And the emoluments clause. I mean, people pointed to a lot of reasons to go after this president since he's been in office. And this Ukraine thing, I think, was probably the straw that broke the camel's back in the sense of just where it fit in the chronology. And also because it's fairly simple and easy to explain if it, in fact, did go down as President Trump's critics believe it did.
True, but you hit the nail on the head. If it's not, and they jumped too quick, it really sets them back in a big way, because it's like, okay, what's next? What, you know? I was literally amazed that they did not wait a day.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, they could have waited a week. You know, they could have waited until. Not only does the, you know, if it's bad for the president, not only does the shoe drop, you know, and the thud gets to maybe reverberate for a couple of days, and the New York Times and Washington Post and Wall Street Journal continue coming out with investigative exposés on various aspects of this thing, and then it's next, you know, next Tuesday, next Wednesday, and the speaker then comes out and says, okay, you know, I think we've waited long enough, let's move ahead. I don't know that there'd be much of anything lost, would there?
But here's what I think happened. I think that, you know, they need 218 votes to have the, you know, to impeach.
Yep.
They're up to 203. And I think what most likely happened was that the speaker, they probably said, hey, this is going to be 218 real soon. And
yep.
So probably what ended up happening, they said, you better get aboard now or otherwise you're on the other end of your caucus.
Well, I still think I think if she had asked for it, they would have given her a week, or, you know, even this weekend.
So.
Who knows?
Yes.
I mean, it didn't have to be next all the way into next Tuesday, Wednesday, but if it had been Friday of this week or you know, over the weekend, I share your observation that this may be they may have jumped the gun a little bit. We'll have to see how it plays out, but yikes. Hey, we've gone a little long, Bob. I really appreciate you fighting through the technical difficulties and joining us this morning. And I appreciate very much. And let's talk again soon.
Thank you.
Some very leading figures here in the U.S. military and in the folks who write about military strategy. And I want to introduce my next guest, who definitely fits in that pantheon. That is Major Ian Brown. He's with the U.S. Marine Corps. He's a helicopter pilot. He's published works on maneuver warfare doctrine and future warfare concepts in the Marine Corps Gazette and online publication War on the Rocks, and is the author of A New Conception of War. And Major Brown, I want to thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And so tell me, what is the new conception of war in your estimation?
So it is the book title I took from a old 1980s briefing by a guy called John Boyd, who was one of the intellectual forebears of the maneuver warfare doctrine that the Marine Corps adopted in the 1980s and still has today. So my goal with writing the book was to sort of just pull the curtain a little back on that piece of history a little bit, because as I was working, I'm a Norris product, by the way, so this book was a direct outgrowth of my master's thesis that I did for the military history program here.
Wow.
And in the course of doing the research, I started off just sort of looking at very broad background of maneuver warfare doctrine in the Marine Corps. You know, I knew a little bit about it in my training, but I thought it was worth going back and looking at. And I realized that there was a whole lot more going on in the period of the debate when maneuver warfare was sort of codified as a concept than I had any appreciation of. So in digging through that, I wanted to just kind of get it out there and make it available again to, you know, generation of Marines and other readers and people interested in military history, because that time period with the debate was not well known, and sort of where the ideas came from was not well known, and I wanted to get that back into the public eye.
Now, for our lay listeners out there who aren't students of military strategy, define maneuver warfare.
Oh, that's one of the excellent questions that came up in the course of the research. Part of the debate was defining what maneuver warfare was, because mm-hmm. there were a lot of different flavors. But the central approach is that it takes a human-oriented perspective on your adversary. It looks at the adversary as a whether it's a group of terrorists or a nation state, it's still a collection of individuals, of human individuals, who make decisions based on their own perceptions of reality. And the idea was to be able to affect your adversary's perception of reality by complicating his perception of what was going on, by making it more confusing, by snipping apart his ability to have his different units act in harmony with each other on the battlefield, to create disorganization, create disorder, and really cloud the human aspect, make the human aspect of it less efficient and functional, so that then you could then impose your will on the adversary, and by having it focused more on human things like behavior and perception and decision-making cycles, you could get what you wanted on a potential battlefield without the necessity of going through and having to destroy everything and kill everybody.
And the one of the issues that we were hearing about earlier today from Peter Warren Singer, the author, he was talking about new technologies that are being applied in warfare these days. This swarm of drones and cruise missiles that hit the Saudi oil facility a couple of weeks ago. Do you agree with him that is a strategy that opens up warfare opportunities essentially to, you know, less well-funded and less well-staffed players than used to be the case?
There's probably something to that, and I'll caveat here before I go much further that the opinions I expressed about my perceptions on war, they're mine. They're not the Krulak Center, Marine Corps University's, Marine Corps, or Department of Defense, or U.S. government. So these are just my thoughts getting out there.
Absolutely.
I think that technology is definitely a new thing on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
But what I sort of try and get at in the book, and I'm looking back through the theory of maneuver warfare, is that the new stuff on the battlefield, they are new vectors going after an old goal, which is to have an impact on the human being at the very end of that technology chain.
Right.
So things like cyber, swarming drones, you know, we're talking more about how we're going to input artificial intelligence as part of our capabilities on the battlefield. There's definitely new stuff out there.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of, you know, sort of the character of war changes, but the nature of war doesn't. And what Boyd was getting at, and when the Marines have sort of kept the maneuver warfare theory as an enduring philosophy, is that the nature of war is that it's always human oriented. So all of these devices are aspects to impact human behavior in the way that you want. You know?
Yeah, that makes sense. Absolutely, you're going after. War is always about going after human decision making. You know, your adversary is doing something that you don't want them to do, and so you're trying to change that up, and your effort is obviously aimed at the, and it sounds like there's I'm speaking as a complete layman here, so bear with me, but probably a balance of approaches here where I mean, it's fascinating to hear you talk about the kind of the focusing on the human thinking that your adversary is doing, and how you need to work around that and develop the strategy you need to change their thinking, and at the same time these new tools come along. It seems change to some extent the strategy, though, and the way one thinks about Dr. Singer was saying that you can actually end up changing a decision about going to war based on the risks of a drone swarm coming at you that wasn't a risk 20 years ago.
Oh, sure, and the proliferation and the relatively inexpensive nature of a lot of these technologies has opened up the aperture for different groups and organizations to sort of play on the global stage in a way that they didn't have the resources or the tools to play on, you know, call it 20, 30 years ago or so. But I want to go kind of back to something that I think still applies in this concept, which I called out in the book, is that something Boyd said, and it's a reminder that these are all the vectors may be new, but the aim is the same. So he once said that train doesn't fight wars, machines don't fight wars, people fight wars, and they use their minds. And so I think what the big change is that now you have different groups who are able to engage in that ability to achieve their own goals in a way that they couldn't before. And it wasn't a lack of will, it was simply a lack of opportunity. Now the opportunity has expanded, mm-hmm. but the ultimate goal of one group trying to influence another to get what they want, to make that group of people change their minds or submit or at least stop interfering, I think that has stayed constant.
And it's so important that you're here and participating in this series of lectures, because you know that seems like it's been at the center of military strategy from the beginning for centuries. Is that fair?
It probably has been fair, yeah. But I think it's always worth kind of going back and revisiting the thought and theory of the past,
sure,
seeing what still applies today and what maybe is less applicable than it was 20 or 30 years ago, and that's kind of going back to my own research on Boyd and the maneuver warfare theories. That was something that was recognized at the time, even as they were trying to adopt this new theory. It's that you can never stop looking at what's going on around you. You have to change and adapt to what's going on in new circumstances, and you can never rest and stop doing that.
All right. Thank you so much, Major Ian Brown, U.S. Marine Corps Major and helicopter pilot. Fascinating conversation. Really appreciate you coming by.
All right. Thanks for the opportunity.
We'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show in a few minutes.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya De Bellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Sure you can appreciate. Hey, we are back here at Norwich University for the Norwich University Military Writers Symposium, and one of the guests here at this two-day event taking place at the Northfield campus of Norwich is David Bellavia. He is originally from Buffalo, New York, served as a staff sergeant in the U.S. Army, joined the Army in 1999, served in the Iraq conflict, and is the only surviving Medal of Honor winner from the Iraq conflict, and it's an honor to have you with us here, this
morning. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, you are back in civilian life, I understand?
I am back in civilian life, and although it's like you enter a wormhole when you get into Norwich, you're right back. You see ghosts of Christmas past and future, and you see what you used to be, and then you see what there's so much optimism and hope here. People tend to look at this new generation and think we're doomed, but as long as we've got these men and women, we're going to be just fine.
Yeah, it must be. Now, did you go to a military school yourself, or just join the Army as a young man?
I joined after college, yeah. And went enlisted, went infantry, and honestly, it's the best decision I've ever made in my life. I really feel that my service has made me a better person, a better citizen. I think veterans make great employees and employers, and you just learn so much. You know, we walk outside, we find a million reasons why we're divided. Everyone's got their own little tribe that they belong to, but we seem to have worked with people we disagreed with that were different than us, worshiped differently, loved differently, and we got the job done. So maybe more civilians in our state capitals and our national capitals, maybe they could learn some lessons from our military.
Yeah, there is this sort of can-do attitude I see so much. I just do have to ask you, as you're walking around the campus here, a lot of uniforms and so on, have you had a little twitch to put up a salute every now and then?
Well, you know, I don't know if you know this, but the fringe benefit of receiving the Medal of Honor is that they have to salute you.
Oh, right. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So I love going to the Pentagon and just walking around with a medal on and going up to Chief of Staff of the Army and being like, hey, four-star, what's going on? I think you owe me something, right? For a staff sergeant of the infantry, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm guessing they take that pretty well, right?
The whole thing is just so humbling. And you know, the other thing, too, is that you realize how this is so random. Combat is just such a crazy, you know, series of events that are just random and lucky. And my award was coming home and being alive and being able to have a family. And so many of my friends didn't have that opportunity. And so, you know, we have to live for those guys and keep their memories alive and remind as many strangers as we can about what these men did for us and what they sacrificed and who they were.
Yeah, it's really seems to be a different world now for veterans than it was, you know, certainly the greatest, quote-unquote, greatest generation coming back from World War II and that sort of thing. And among the issues you see all the time these days are really tough, lingering health effects that may not be just obvious when you see somebody walking down the street, but are still very, very tough to deal with. What about your own experiences in this regard? Do you have any lingering issues in your own life from that service?
Well, you know, the point you bring up is something that not a lot of people, I haven't really heard that a lot. I give you a lot of credit for that. These symptoms sometimes take 15, 20 years, right?
Yeah.
You could be in your 50s and 60s and the fireworks go off and all of a sudden you're back in, you know, wherever you were at war. But I really think that as beautiful and as brave and incredible as the World War II generation was, I really believe, in my heart, my greatest generation is that Vietnam generation who, you know, served against their will, didn't even know where they were going to fight, didn't quite oftentimes even understand what they were fighting. And yet, when they came home, treated with such disrespect, never told thank you, never told welcome home, and yet their sons come home from Iraq, Afghanistan, and it's the Vietnam generation that really protected us from a lot of that. The Vietnam generation that did for us what nobody did for them. And that, to me, is the ultimate definition of love. It shows their empathy, it shows their selflessness, and it shows to me that I think that's the greatest generation, because if you can give something to another generation that you didn't receive yourself, it speaks volumes about the Vietnam warrior.
That's really fascinating. So basically the thing that they put out there that you're honoring right now is a sort of a defense of what you folks were doing in your generation. Is that the idea?
Well, I think what I'm trying to remind, you know, as many Americans as possible. It's when you get this award, it's almost like it's a little bit like Miss America, where you get to pick a, you know, what do you want to do? My thing is cat decline, and I want to, you know, you pick a topic of what you want to do, and the Army sends you around the country. And what I'm just trying to remind folks is that, you know, we have service. There's so much. I mean, we focus on the uniform and we focus on military service, but everyone should be serving their country, whether it's in a soup kitchen, it's in your school. As long as we acknowledge that this great experiment is worthy of defense, and how we can defend that is by reminding young people of the importance of service and getting out there and giving back to our communities, giving back to our way of life. I think that's really important, and that's what we need to sustain democracy.
And here at Norwich University, obviously there's a number of civilian students here, and then there's the Corps of Cadets. It's kind of a dual-purpose institution here. What's your sense, just being here yesterday and today, I guess, so far, of how they have been able to instill that notion of service in the students here?
You know, it's so incredible. I go to a lot of colleges, and I've got my oldest son is a sophomore in college right now. So many colleges in the United States, they foster this, you know, it's almost like perpetual adolescence. Let's be as young as we can for as long as we can. Mm-hmm. Peter Pan syndrome. You want to color in a book when you're 35? Go ahead, do that. Live in your mom's basement. Mm-hmm. Keep the band together. Work on your independent film. Whatever it is, go ahead and do it. Let's be young. At Norwich, in the United States Army, in the Marine Corps, in the military, we crush adolescents. We basically say, look, that you had a time to be young. Now's the time to grow up. This is about adulting. The world runs with adults making tough decisions. You're not always going to be popular. You're not always going to be appreciated. But this is what it takes to get things done. This is the sacrifice that's needed to preserve comfort for so many millions of Americans. And Norwich is about creating adults, men and women, and that's really what we need today.
That's a I'm sure the folks here at Norwich hearing you say this are loving it, because I would imagine that's a terrific message for them. So that's a good thing. Hey, I got to read some of this, an account here of your actions in the Iraq war, read from it, and because this is an incredible story. The actions for which you received the Medal of Honor occurred, this is in the second Battle of Fallujah, on your 29th birthday, right? You were in the 1st Infantry Division, and your platoon was assigned during Operation Phantom Fury to clear a block of 12 buildings from which insurgents were firing on American forces. The platoon began searching house to house. At the 10th house, Bellavia fatally shot an insurgent preparing to load a rocket-propelled grenade. A second insurgent fired at him, and Bellavia wounded him in the shoulder. When Staff Sergeant Bellavia entered a bedroom, the wounded insurgent followed, forcing Bellavia to kill him. When another insurgent began firing from upstairs, the battle, it goes on to this intense scene of hand-to-hand combat, where you end up actually killing one of the insurgents by stabbing him in the collarbone. You decided not to use firearms at that point because you're in a room full of propane tanks and plastic explosives, and you worried about, I'm sure, blowing up the whole building and killing yourself in the process. And does anything prepare you for a scene like that?
Yeah, I think it just, combat distilled down is just a series of challenges. You know what separates us from the enemy is that, you know, a lot of the violence of action and combat really comes from love of your friends and your unit and your hometown and your family and your country and your army. And so much of that love is what makes you do things you wouldn't normally do. You know, I was telling the people at Norwich today is that, you know, peer pressure makes you smoke cigarettes at 11, and peer pressure also makes you kick down a door, and it makes you clear a road with bombs. It really depends who your peers are, you know, and if you're surrounded by good people, you're going to feel the pressure to do good things because that's your peer group. And the soldiers of 2-2 Infantry in the 1st Infantry Division were some of the most beautiful, decent, honorable men I've ever met in my life. And they risked their lives for me, and I had an obligation to do the same.
That is, I think, a great summation of why and how people serve in the military. I mean, I've never been in the military myself, and I sometimes wonder, could I actually go through with the kind of stuff that's described in that story of your activities that day in Fallujah? And
I'll tell you what, yeah. I can guarantee you would.
Really?
And every person I meet that asks me the same thing, I just have to ask them, who in your life do you love? Who do you care about? And if you saw them in imminent danger, how would you respond? And I'm sure you have at least 25 stories of things that you've done for people that you care about. All combat is a gross exaggeration of those moments, you know?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. It is in extremis, you know. I mean, it's out there.
It's hyperbole.
Yeah, that would be one way to describe it. And I do have to honor the folks who are signing up. Basically, you know, you enlisted in 1999 in the United States Army. You had graduated from college, I get it. What was your degree in when you graduated?
I was a theater and biochem major.
Theater and biochem. That's one of the wackiest combos. My son was a Spanish and classical guitar major, and I said, well, at least they play classical guitar in Spain.
In Spain, right, yeah, right.
So
yeah.
That kind of makes sense.
But, you know, the journey, everywhere it goes. I'll tell you what, though. there is something about, you know, if you play poker and you know the art of the bluff, there's a lot of times where you have to look at people and you know, there's bad things down the street, but I'm going to tell you right now that we got this handled and we're prepared for any situation that presents itself. But a lot of that is, you know, not you're acting when you're saying that you've got this under control, because you really don't, but you find a way.
That is that is amazing. Now, you originally from Buffalo, the Buffalo, New York area, or the city itself?
I was born in the city. I grew up in the rural areas out by Lake Ontario.
Oh, I see. Okay, and you you're back in that area now. And I understand you're a talk radio host in Buffalo.
I do a show Monday through Friday with a partner, Tom Bowerly, and we're out in Buffalo, and we do the drive afternoon drive show and. It's great. I mean, it's like being in the barracks. We're just talking all day and you know, playing cards and doing our thing.
The you have a book also called House to House.
That's right. It's a book came out Simon & Schuster in 2007, ages ago, but it's been re-released with the Medal of Honor edition, and it's the proceeds. I set up a relief fund for my unit. Really, a lot of these guys anyone that's having difficulties, you know, we want to make sure we take care. You know, some of these guys set up charities that help the greater good of veterans, and I'm all about helping veterans, but I want to help my individual guys, the guys I care about, the guys I serve with, and the proceeds of House to House go right to them.
Wow.
So
wow.
If they're having issues, anything from getting home on leave to you know, providing whatever they have to do, we're there for them.
And your unit was how large? How many men consider your unit?
Well, my unit, I include everyone who served in Iraq. So the anyone in my task force, it's up to 2,200 people.
Wow. Okay.
But we, you know, obviously the Alpha Company guys. You think of a platoon like a classroom. Mm-hmm. A company is like a graduating class, and your battalion is your high school.
Okay. So so when you refer to your unit, you're talking about the classroom.
I'm talking about the high school.
The high school.
Yeah,
okay.
We're gonna help all the engineers, military, police, anyone who was over there with us, you know, with our unit insignia, we're going to take care of them.
Wow. And do you have any sense of what percentage of this group, you said what, 2,200 roughly?
Yeah, about that.
What percentage of the 2,200 are experiencing difficulties now tied to their service, would you say?
You know, veterans are super stubborn when it comes to getting help. We're conditioned to take care of ourselves. We're conditioned to never ask for assistance. And only when you really get, they're not going to go to, one of the problems we see with the VA is that a lot of people just don't want to go and admit that they're having issues.
Yeah.
So in that peer group, in that small circle of 2 a.m. conversation, that's when you find out the guys that need it. So my whole thing is that I don't want to put them in a category or a statistic, but I'm just saying, come to us and talk it out. And most of these guys, they want to be well for their families.
Sure.
They want to get back to normal. It's just a matter of defining what normal is.
Yeah, there's a whole range of stuff. I mean, you know, coming out of the first Iraq War, I remember there were a lot of injuries related to some of the weapons being used and so on.
Right.
There's also just psychological stuff that happens and difficulties like that.
You know, combat is just so abhorrent. It's ghoulish and ghastly. But a lot of those experiences are also some of the best experiences of your life, because you see love, you see sacrifice, you see the essence of what it is to live. But we're either victimized and imprisoned by it, or we're empowered by it. So we try to focus on the ways that it makes us strong and better.
Yeah. Well, David Bellavia, I'm impressed. I got to say, it's great to meet you, and I really honor your service, and I'm sure join a lot of other Americans in thanking you for it. And the way you're continuing to speak out, I'm sure through your radio program and through your charitable work and so on, it's tremendous. So.
Well, hey, thank you, and congratulations on what you're doing here. And this was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Good. I'm glad you're able to to join us. And I wanted to mention a couple of things about the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. One of them is our podcast. If you missed any of this conversation or any of these conversations I've had this morning, which I found fascinating, I hope listeners have as well, you can always tune in later. Go to WDEVradio.com, follow the link from there to the Dave Graham Show, scroll down a bit, you'll find a list of our recent programs by topic and guest, and be able to listen to everything from military writers to yesterday's conversation about diversity, preserving seed diversity in various crops. And so lots of subjects come up on the show, and it's always a lot of fun for me. Hope it is as well for you listeners. Hey, that's about it for Wednesday's edition of the Dave Graham Show here from Norwich University, where we're having the Norwich Military Writers Symposium. And join me again tomorrow for another edition of the Dave Graham Show. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre and Common Sense Radio. Have a great day, everybody.